America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
24% of Americans underinsured. 43% of Americans say the insurance they have is somewhat, or because of the insurance that they have, they are somewhat or completely unprepared to cope with costly medical emergencies. Our infrastructure and our bridges are falling apart. And over on one of the conservative websites, we'll be sharing more with you about this shortly. 43% of Americans say that the reason our bridges are falling apart is because we're spending too much money on the welfare state. Al Perinello has some strong opinions about this and who should vote. He's a highly successful entrepreneur, radio station owner, multimillionaire, and has a website, preservetheamericandream.com. Al, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for showing up. You have come out and said that people who don't pay income taxes should not be allowed to vote. Why?
Well, I think we have to start at the beginning. You know, there's an awful lot going on out there that people just really don't have a handle on and they don't understand. The first of which is that, jobs, the people who are working today are paying an inordinate amount of taxes.
Really? Compared to what?
Well, compared to those who aren't working. So the bottom line is that, you know, we have a society out there where the top levels of the income earners are paying, obviously, the vast amount of taxes.
But so I just want to get a handle on this. I'm not quite sure I understand, Al, what you're saying. Right now, our tax rates are a third of what they were when John Kennedy was president, our income tax rates. Uh-huh. And they're a fifth of what they were when Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower were president. And Dwight Eisenhower was of the opinion that that was just fine, thank you very much. He used that money to build the American highway system and schools and bridges and hospitals and airports and rail beds and all sorts of good stuff, I think. You know, most of us agree, stuff that made it possible for people like you to become millionaires. And now we've got a tax rate that's about a fifth of that, and we've stopped building that stuff, and you're saying we're paying too much taxes?
No. What I'm saying is that the people who are earning the money at the very top levels are paying an outrageous amount of these taxes.
Why?
Well, let's take a look at the figures. Top 1% of American income earners today are paying something in the area of 37% of all the taxes, income taxes in this country.
Don't you think that they're using 37% of all of the major infrastructure that's necessary to generate that income that's taxable?
No,
they're using 37% of the publicly paid for educated workforce.
Nope. No, I don't think that. As a matter of fact, I think that the people who are not paying taxes are using most of the infrastructure in America.
Yeah.
Primarily, well, I mean, look, you know, we can have a disagreement here. I mean, that is allowable, is it not? I think that there's a position that you're taking that the people who are paying all the taxes are using all the services. Simply not true. The people who aren't paying the taxes in this country are using the vast majority of the services that are provided.
So the vast majority of the services provided by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Department of the Treasury, a vast court system that enforces corporate contracts, those are being paid for by people working minimum wage at Walmart.
No, but you're selective.
Or those are being used by, excuse
you're being,
me.
You're being exceedingly selective. I'm telling you that the top 10% of American income earners today are paying about 70% of all the taxes.
About half of our total tax bill, L, right now is going for defense. And most.
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you.
About half of our total tax bill right now is going to pay for defense, $500 billion last
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
And most of, and solidly, and I, you know, this is these are numbers that Republicans will give you. You know, solidly a third of that, and maybe arguably as much as half of that, is in protection of U.S. trade interests.
Okay.
Both oil, you know, around the world, and
right.
and shipping and trade routes.
Okay.
So here we have half of our entire tax bill being paid to defend the interests of corporate America, and you're saying that the guy working at Walmart who's working a minimum wage job and therefore doesn't pay any income taxes is a bum and has taken all the infrastructure, has taken all the value from the taxes? I don't get it.
Tom, you're writing my speech, and you're completely wrong. I mean, with all due respect, I didn't say that. You did. What I'm saying
yeah,
is that
did.
With that 40%, the top 40% of everyone in this country who is earning an income are paying 100% of all the income taxes in America, which means, Tom, that 60% are paying zero income taxes. Now, if that makes sense to you, then I, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's a lost battle.
Well, what it says, what it says to me, Al, is that, first of all, you and I both know that that bottom 60% are paying a lot of taxes. They're paying FICA, they're paying Social Security, they're paying sales taxes, they're paying property taxes directly or indirectly through rents. I mean, they're paying an enormous amount of tax.
Tom,
they're paying gasoline taxes.
Once again, that's not.
I know, we're talking about income taxes.
Yeah.
But just to keep it back to income taxes,
says
to me, what's horrifying to me about your statistic, Al, is that what it says is that 60% of Americans are earning such an absolutely pathetically lousy income in the United States that they're not even in a taxable income bracket.
No, the top 40%, you know, we're talking about a level that is as low as $43,000. So, you know, once again, what needs to be understood from the very basic.
So you're telling me if I earn $43,000 a year, I pay no taxes?
If you have 19 kids, probably not.
And the average American has 19 kids?
No, but the bottom line is that there's enough of them who have such outrageous amount of children that they are excused from paying income taxes. The bottom line is you either accept the numbers or you don't. Now, you can twist them any way you wish, but the reality is that 60% of Americans who work are not paying income taxes. Income taxes are 50% of the taxes or more.
You know, about half of the Fortune 500 companies that showed a profit last year of over $400 million paid no or over $40 million paid no taxes either.
Okay. What I'm talking about are...
I mean, you want the real deadbeats. The corporate tax receipts during the Eisenhower administration accounted for 32% of all federal revenues. Right now it's 9%.
Okay.
And it's not like corporations have suddenly gotten poor.
Well, you know,
but here's the question. Why should poor people not be allowed to vote?
The real question is that poor people, first of all, was not what I said. What I said was people who do not pay taxes should not be allowed to vote.
Right. Why?
And that's the position of my organization. Well, very simply, because the reason they're not paying taxes is because they're excused from paying taxes, and many of them, the vast majority of them, in my opinion, should be paying taxes because they are artificially on specific welfare rolls and free government program rolls and so on. See, the one part of the equation that you're not factoring in, Tom, is the fact that I came from that community. That was me. I was born into a situation that was, you know, what would be considered today to be poverty. I mean, I was the guy who sat home and had Campbell's soup poured for dinner because that's what we could afford. So I've been there.
So?
I get it. I've been amongst these people, and I'm here to tell you that there is such fraud going on. There are people who are on welfare rolls. When I was younger, I remember when welfare was a good thing.
Do you mean to seriously tell me, Al Perinello, Al Perinello, that with the website to preservetheamericandream.com, do you mean to seriously tell me that the amount of fraud that's going on in Iraq right now in a month is less than the amount of fraud that's going on in the entire American welfare system in a year?
Tom, I would
shove those numbers right back down your throat, and you know it.
Tom, you have your own agenda, and you're trying to weave it into this discussion. I don't know what the fraud ratio is in.
Well, I'm talking according to the Pentagon itself, you know.
Well, that's great. You know, why don't you have a guest on who knows about that stuff and have a great discussion with him? But I'm here to tell you about my life and what I've organized and Preserve the American Dream, .com was born. Because I am frustrated, and I honestly believe that the American dream, as we have all depended on the American dream in our lives, everyone seeks to reach their own American dream.
Al, isn't the American dream to become part of the middle class, be able to raise your family, put your kids through school, have health care, and have a pension? Isn't that the American dream?
Sure.
Okay. Then why is it that a large chunk of America is earning so little in trying to accomplish that American dream, that they are, you know, by your definition, not even paying taxes? And why would you want to disenfranchise those people from voting?
Tom, you're not going to like the answer, but the answer is why? Why are they earning so little? Because we're paying them to sit home on their fat asses. That's why.
I really think that if you walk into any Walmart or any... frankly, the vast majority of the retail sector these days, you're not going to find people sitting on their fat asses. You're going to find people working their butts off and not making enough money to pay taxes.
Well, you know, once again, I came from the community. I know how people, you know, are exploiting these government programs. I know how they're...
People can check it out at your website. Al, thanks for an interesting conversation. Al Perinello, PreserveTheAmericanDream.com. Good talking
thanks,
to you, Al.
Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
But if it's the American dream you're looking for, forget it. Well, you know, what can I say? Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson. There is an artificial aristocracy founded on wealth and birth with neither virtue nor talents. This artificial aristocracy is a mischievous ingredient in government, and provisions should be made to prevent its ascendancy. As I've said, I think it's time for us to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. And I was surprised to hear a conservative on this program yesterday say the same thing. Yes, time to roll back the Reagan. Forget the Bush tax cuts. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Let's take this country back to where we were in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s when we were actually building a nation. By the way, a special opportunity just for our listeners in New York City today. So if you're outside of New York City, you know, put your fingers in your ears for just a minute. And this is just for our listeners in WWRL here in Manhattan or in the New York, who can get to Manhattan. Tonight at 7 o'clock, there is going to be a special free screening. I'm making this announcement at the request of Warner Brothers, the distributor of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, which is premiering tomorrow night. Or tomorrow in Hollywood, and Leo will be there. Big, great big deal. But tonight we're going to have a special screening. It's no cost. You do have to RSVP. You do have to call a number and say, please put me on the list. And it is first come, first serve. And I, along with three other people who are in the movie, will be doing a question and answer afterwards. And then after that, there's a reception at a green building a few blocks from the theater. And this is all happening tonight at no cost in Manhattan. And if you want the information and you want the phone number to RSVP, go to TomHartman.com, my website, and scroll down a little bit. On the left, you'll see my schedule. I think it says Tom's calendar, Tom's schedule, whatever. Click on that schedule page and just scroll down to August 17th, and there's all the information there, along with the phone number for Jill with Warner Brothers, who is the person that you had the RSVP with. So if you're in Manhattan and you'd like to say hi tonight, you'd like to meet me, you'd like to meet some of the other people in the movie, you'd like to see the entire movie, the 11th Hour, put together by and starring Leonardo DiCaprio, and I'm in it along with a whole bunch of other people. It's a documentary on the state of the world, global warming, and more. Go to TomHartman.com and click on my calendar. And Tom's schedule, right off the homepage there from the TomHartman.com, that'll take you to a page where you will find the telephone number to RSVP if you live in Manhattan. This is only for people in New York City. And so just a quick tip, and have fun with that. Our number, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com, our website, AirAmerica.com, our blog. If you want to participate in our blog, go over to AirAmerica.com, click on the Tom Hartman program, and it'll get you there. The FISA disaster that we talked about at some length yesterday, in fact, it pretty much occupied the show. The FISA disaster now being editorialized against. It's amazing. It's frankly amazing. I mean, yesterday I went off on a rant on this thing. And today, USA Today, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all basically calling out the small number. Now, keep in mind, the small number of Democrats and the majority of Republicans, virtually all of the Republicans, and in the House, 41 Democrats, in the Senate, 16 Democrats, a small number of Democrats and the vast majority, in fact, I believe virtually all of the Republicans, cowards. Now, the editorials don't use that word. That's my word. In my opinion, those 16 Democrats in the Senate, those 41 Democrats in the House, and all of the Republicans who voted for to make what George Bush was doing, which was illegal, legal, so that now if there are impeachment proceedings against him or even censure proceedings like Russ Feingold has suggested, his defense will be, hey, it's legal now. Why are you prosecuting me? What I did is, you know, might have been illegal then, but it's legal now. These people, in my opinion, are cowards. As the New York Times said in their editorial today, while serving little purpose, the new law has real dangers. It would allow the government to intercept without a warrant every communication into or out of any country, including the United States. Instead of explaining all this to American voters, the minimal benefits and the enormous risks, the Democrats, and I would add all of the Republicans, have allowed Mr. Bush and his fear-mongering to dominate all discussions on terrorism and national security, end quote. That's not some left-wing blogger. That's the official top-of-the-fold editorial in today's New York Times. In the Washington Post, the main editorial in the Washington Post, to call this legislation ill-considered is to give it too much credit. It was scarcely considered at all. Instead, it was strong-armed through both chambers by an administration that seized the opportunity to write its warrantless wiretapping program into law, or more precisely, to write it out from under any legal restrictions. And in USA Today, a skittish Congress allowed itself to be stampeded last week into granting the president unfettered surveillance power when it returns to Washington. It should do what it can to make sure the sun goes down on this flawed measure. Amen. So call your legislators about this. And should people who only earn a minimum wage not be allowed to vote? 27 minutes past here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Never be afraid.
Just as long as you stand by me.
See, we've got to stick together here, Americans. My friends, we've got to stick together. By the way, Louise posted over at AirAmerica.com, just to make it a whole lot easier for you. If you go to AirAmerica.com and just click on Tom Hartman, right at the very top there. 7 p.m. screening of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour, at the Regal Battery Park Stadium 11 Theater, 102 North End Avenue. And then 8:30, right after the screening, there will be a Q&A with me, with Jan Tribby, Elwin Gladstone, J. Christopher Daly. And then at 9:15, there will be a reception at the Riverhouse Sales and Discovery Center, an eco-friendly apartment building and center at the Four World Trade Financial Center, approximately 2 blocks from the theater, to RSVP these events. And you must RSVP in order to attend. First come, first serve. When the tickets are gone, they're gone. You can't buy these tickets. To RSVP to attend, give Jill a call on her phone number. She's with Warner Brothers, and her phone number is there on our page at airamerica.com. Click on Tom Hartman page. It's right up at the top. Just as a heads up for our friends here in New York City, where we're broadcasting the show from live all this week. I'm here at in the mothership, and it really is like a spaceship in here in the control room. With Chris and Lauren running all these controls, all this gee whiz stuff, and it's like I'm looking out here, and there's Chris in the Captain Kirk seat, and here's Lauren and Sulu. See, yeah, okay, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, and just it's the, all the, you know, oh, it's just amazing.
Or Georgie, if you're from the, or whatever his name was, in the Next Generation.
Yes.
I was a Next Generation fan.
Yeah, that being Chris LaPresto, who's...
hi, everybody.
Hopping in there. Yeah, you know, I don't think I ever saw the Next Generation.
You're kidding me.
No, we went like 18 years without a TV, and I have this big cultural hole in my knowledge of American culture, so all the years we were raising our kids. Anyhow... Should the poor not be allowed to vote just because they don't pay taxes? Or alternatively, hey, if you're a millionaire, should you get 2 votes? If you're a billionaire, should you get 20 votes? It's a strange concept, but, you know, who knows? 1-866-303-2270. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, listening on WTKG. Hey, Tomas, what's up?
Mr. Hartman, I tell you what, you are the only one out there in the entire radio world that will take on the other side, and not just the light hitters. You take up the cleanup home run hitters courageously, and I just have to say that is outstanding. It's too bad you're not running for office, but
that's never going to happen, Tomas. Never going to happen.
You know, you just played a song that said, you won't be afraid if you stand by me. I'll stand by you, bro.
Yeah, well, I think, see, that's what you're doing right now is listening to the program, supporting our sponsors, supporting WTKG. We're all standing together in this, not just in radio, but in America. I mean, you know, join.
Hey, Tom. Listen,
yeah, go ahead.
I worked at NSA, baby. I remember, okay, when I got in there, and about a month later, they sent us to this little room, and there was this lawyer from the Attorney General's office. Jan Arena was in charge back then, and they were just telling us how important it was not to violate the 72-hour rule. That's the rule that said you had 72 hours to figure out if the the communications were between a terrorist or a drug trafficker and an American citizen or
right.
not.
And thus you had to take it to the FISA court.
Right, but we had 72 hours to figure it out. And let me tell you what, our supervisors were on us like white on rice on that. Mm. I mean, if we had any doubt, we had to just destroy everything.
Yeah.
Destroy everything.
Yeah.
And so,
Tomas, a question for you. You've been calling into this show, and so I assume you've been listening for at least 3 years. And back 3-4 years ago, when you first started calling in, you'd call in and say, I'm a conservative and you're crazy. Have you changed your mind?
I don't think I ever called you crazy. I still am conservative.
Okay.
But, the older you get, the more you value values. For example, that caller who said, if you don't pay taxes, you shouldn't vote. Well, maybe we should have a rule that says if you make, $1 million a year, you don't need to vote. You know?
Yeah, I mean, there you go.
What percentage of the troops in Iraq that have died have been millionaires?
Or have been paying taxes, for that matter. I mean,
ouch.
Yeah, seriously, what's the income for an E-1? I mean, at an entry level in
right.
the military, you're talking, what, $15,000 a year,
yes.
something like that?
Not,
I mean, it's
not making any income tax payments
yeah.
at all.
It ain't a whole
and
lot.
And Lord have mercy, the guy said, they're having too many children, you know?
Yeah.
So that shows you the values.
Well, not to say that this is the case with Al, our guest, because I don't want to pick on our guests when they're not around to defend themselves. Folks say, they're having too many children, the they that they're talking about are people of color, and it's code language for basically racist sentiments, and that's what's going on. Tomas, I got to move along. I got a whole bunch of calls here. Thanks a lot for calling.
You run for president, boy. Run for president.
In your dreams. Thanks a lot, Tomas. Rich in New York City. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Tom. I just want to comment on your last guest, the guy who said that poor people shouldn't vote or those
right.
who don't pay taxes. You know, it seems to me what his basis of his argument is that he is afraid that someone out there is nickel and diming the government unfairly, taking tax money away from him at, say, $500 a month or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to prove to me that there are 16 million people in America stealing $500 a month from our government, that costs, that's the amount that's being stolen by this war.
Hmm.
16 million people. I mean, if I'm doing my math right, it's about $8 billion a month, $9 billion a month.
So that would be 16 million people pulling $500 a month. Oh, that's interesting.
You know, yeah. And if that's what they're arguing about, then fine. Make that the monetary argument and say, fine, we'll clean up welfare. I have no problem.
Yeah, but I'm telling you, welfare got cleaned up a long time ago. I mean, Bill Clinton went so far. What Bill Clinton did to welfare is like, trying to clean a spot off your arm with a Brillo pad a half hour later and you got blood running down your arm. I mean, that's what was done to welfare in the United States.
And there's also, and that's just the issue of the war. And then, you know, the Congress this weekend just, took away $16 billion in subsidies for oil.
Yeah.
This weekend, and no one's talking about that, and I don't know why. I think that was the trade-off
yep.
for, I think that was trade-off for FISA.
Yeah, no, it's among other things. It's just incredible how the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. And now we've got an entire movement where, you know, over at Newsmax, they're saying 46% of people in their poll said that the reason why the bridge fell in Minneapolis was because too much money was being siphoned off by the welfare state. Come on, human welfare in the United States is something like 1 or 2% of the entire federal budget. It's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Alan in Beverly Hills, California. Hey, Alan.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Okay, if I was one of the news conferences Bush had several months ago, and he was talking about the FISA law was 38 years old and basically had a right to change it. Well, if I would have stood up and I said, Mr. Bush, the Constitution is about 230 years old. You think you have a right to violate that? Of course you have.
Yeah.
And your Bible, what is that, 2,000 years ago? And you violate that every day. I mean, it's such a imbecilic, remark.
You're absolutely right, Alan. It's a tragic remark. But the fact of the matter is, though, the FISA law did not envision things like instant messaging, and it did need to have that added to it. But that's not. And that's what the Democrats originally proposed. And then the Bush administration said, no, we don't want just that. We want you to legalize everything we've been doing. By the way, just a great quote. Roy in New Mexico just sent this to me. John Kenneth Galbraith. I believe we've quoted this before. The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. Carolyn in Richmond, Virginia. Hey, Carolyn, welcome to the program.
You.
I'm great. What's up?
I would like to ask you that gentleman caller that called and was talking about the poor people shouldn't be able to vote.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I understood him to say that was the larger part of the population. Is that not true, what he said?
Yeah, he was saying, and I don't quite get this, but he was saying that only 40% of the population pays income taxes.
Oh, so then this gentleman must advocate an apartheid government.
Well, I think if you're talking about the entire 300 million of us in the United States, about 70 or 80 million of us are under 21 and can't vote anyway, or under 17 or whatever. You know, there's teenagers and there's kids and there's the very elderly and the infirm.
What about senior citizens who do not work or people on disability?
Well, certainly they should be allowed to vote. I mean, my point, I didn't mean the senior citizens shouldn't be voting. My point was there are some who are mentally incapacitated. They're not capable of voting or pretty much anything else, unfortunately, tragically. You know, people in end-stage nursing homes and things. I mean, there's at both ends of life, there are many Americans. So when we talk about Americans, I think it's more important to talk about voting-age Americans, or for that matter, working-age Americans, but particularly voting-age Americans. We want as many people to vote as possible in the United States. It's just a basic, you know, bottom-line thing. Carolyn, thanks for the call. Good point. John and Anacortes, Washington? John? No, John. John is not there. We'll go to Mike in Queens. Hey, Mike, got about a half a minute before we got to take a break. What's up?
Got to thank you for having a guest like that. You know, I've never heard such institutionalized disdain for the poor as that guest put forth. And does he have no regard for the Bill of Rights?
Well, it reflects a perspective that you will find very widespread in the United States.
You know, I was waiting for your next guest to be Ashton Kutcher to tell us that the whole audience was just punked by listening to his garbage.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mike. Good to hear from you. Oh, my. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. It's airamerica.com, particularly if you're in New York. If you're in New York, you want to check out, you want to see us tonight, say hi, check it out, airamerica.com.
In broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Alan driving in Texas, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just my point that I wanted to make is about taxation just in general and the arguments conservatives make. They'll make arguments against a progressive tax system. These days, they'll make arguments against paying taxes and just any taxes in
general. Well, there's a big movement that the Wall Street Journal has been cheerleading for to eliminate all corporate income taxes, for example.
Yeah.
And now they've got taxes down to income generated from capital gains and dividends, people who sit on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, down to a maximum of 15% a year.
And I think what their basic point that they try to make is this, is that, well, it's our money. So you can't, collectively, the country shouldn't be able to tax it because it's our money. And I just want to say, I believe technically that's wrong. If you look at a dollar bill, it says Federal Reserve Note. The Federal Reserve is a proxy of the United States government, and the government is a democracy. So in my mind, in the truest sense, the money technically is owned by us collectively, and we can regulate it. To the extent that a person, we can say to a person, can accumulate this wealth, okay, you can use our money and accumulate more of it to the extent that you don't damage the public good.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a point that's lost.
That was a point that Jefferson made in a number of different occasions and a number of different ways that I have in both my books, What Would Jefferson Do and Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. But here's I think, Alan, perhaps an easier metaphor. Imagine that you walk into a 7-Eleven and you pick up a Hershey bar, and let's say it's a buck, just for sake of argument. I don't know what they sell for these days, but you pick up a candy bar, and at that point, and you've got a dollar in your pocket. Now, at that point, that dollar in your pocket is your money, and that candy bar is the property of the 7-Eleven. Now, you're still inside the 7-Eleven. You open the candy bar, and you take a bite out of it. At that point, you still haven't paid for it. At that point, is that dollar in your pocket still your money?
You still haven't paid for it, so...
I'd say it's not your money anymore because you have used the product. So you have entered into, by your behavior, essentially, a contract with 7-Eleven. Now that you've taken a bite out of that candy bar, you owe them a dollar for it. You can't set it back down on the counter.
And part of that dollar should pay for the court that are going to enforce 7-Eleven's side of that.
Well, yeah, but see, my point is that right. People say, hey, my paycheck is my money. And the fact of the matter is that on the way here to the Air America studios, I used roads that are paid for by taxes. I am able to talk to you because I got an education that was paid for by taxes. I drank water this morning that was pure because of tax dollars. When I took a shower and flushed the toilet and things this morning, the streets didn't run with raw sewage like they do in countries where I have worked and been because of tax dollars. My paycheck actually has value in a bank because the banking system is regulated with tax dollars and because the currency is stabilized with tax dollars. In other words, there's a thousand, probably you could come up with a list of at least hundreds of things that just in the ordinary course of a day all of us use that are the commons. The air that I'm breathing is not terribly poisoned like it is in many parts of the world because we have OSHA and the EPA, and that's paid for with tax dollars. So I would say that from the time I woke up this morning, or arguably even while I was sleeping last night, from the time I woke up this morning until this moment, the money that I've earned doing this show, a portion of that actually isn't my money, because I've already taken a bite out of the candy bar. I've already used many of those resources. And at the end of the month, when I pay my taxes, I'm paying for that candy bar that I've already started, you know, chewing on, even though I haven't walked up to the counter and paid for it. Is that a, I think that that's the best metaphor, but you know.
I think that's a terrific metaphor. I just hope that we haven't gotten to the point as a country to where all of the things that you just lined out that are the you know, the infrastructure of the country and of our economy, that all of those things don't have to collapse before we go back to them and maintain them.
Yeah, well, that's what these guys want, Alan, and spot on. And the reason they want them to collapse is so that they can be handed over to private for-profit corporations, so that the very rich and powerful in this country can make a buck off the stuff that a buck shouldn't be made off of. Great call. Thanks a lot for the point you made. Isado in Phoenix?
Yes, Isatu.
Isatu, I'm sorry.
No problem. I'd like to make a comment on the non-citizen eligible income thing that the man was talking about earlier.
Yes.
Well, with the Clinton administration, the welfare system was completely flipped upside down and defunded a lot.
Yes.
Then under the Bush administration, it's been defunded even further. And then locally with the Phoenix issues that's going on, we've had a lot of private companies coming in taking over these offices. It's no longer in the hands of the government. It's some private thing, you know, that right. There's something locally called Maximus, and that's for people that are looking for jobs or are employed, because of the vast majority of the people that are in the AFDC program, which is what it's properly called, Aid for Family and Dependent Children, then they are working people. They are working. They're not sitting at home. They're not doing anything. And if they're not working, they are at school, because it is absolutely prohibited for anyone not to be doing anything unless you have a mental disorder or a disability. Believe me, they kick you right off the rolls if you're not proving that you're doing
something. Did you say that in Phoenix there are private for-profit corporations making a buck off administering welfare?
Yes, as well as the
that is horrible.
The cards.
That is horrible. That is terrible. Somebody's making a profit off the social safety net. That's incredible. Thank you very much for the call and for clarifying all these issues. It's well said and well done. 57 minutes past the hour. Is free trade going to save us or kill us? Coming up next. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. And again, a special tip just for the folks listening on WWRL or whatever, you know, here in New York City. We have a special screening tonight. No charge, but you must RSVP. Tickets are first come, first served. The information's over at airamerica.com. Click on the Tom Hartman Program, and it's right up there at the top.
Robin Meredith is on the line with us. She is the author of The Elephant and the Dragon, The Rise of India and China, and What It Means for All of Us. So Robin is also a reporter with Forbes magazine. Hey, Robin, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us. You, in the Elephant and the Dragon, you are basically writing about this extraordinary and explosive growth of China and India. Give us a snapshot.
Sure. Basically, the book talks, it's called The Elephant and the Dragon, but it really talks about three countries, India, China, and the United States, how we in the U.S. ought to respond to the dramatic changes in the global economy. You know, we have right before our eyes two giant nations embracing both globalization and capitalism at the same time, and technology that allows them all of a sudden to be connected with our world. That is a huge, huge change in the global economy. I call it tectonic economics.
Okay. It seems that this illustrates a number of things. First, that capitalism and democracy are not necessarily tied at the hip, as has been peddled to us, because here you have a violent dictatorship that murders their own people that has become one of the most powerful capitalist nations in the world, China. Secondly, China is aggressively protecting their own domestic economy. They will not allow, for example, our investment companies to own banks, their own brokerage firms. This was the story in the Financial Times yesterday. Henry Paulson over there begging them to, and they said, well, maybe we'll let you participate in some small joint ventures, him formerly from Goldman Sachs. India, 97% of the entire retail sector in the country of India is owned by small local businesses. They refuse to allow Walmart or any, even an indigenous company to grow. So they're taking the steps that we were actually taking here in the United States from the founding of this country up until the 1980s to protect their domestic economies and grow their domestic economies. At the same time that we're kicking the doors open, doing away with all of these protections for our economy is sinking, our middle class is being destroyed, these economies are growing. Why are we not learning these lessons?
Well, Tom, I think there are a few. You raised a lot of points in that. First of all, the Chinese and Indian economies are opening, but as you point out, they were completely closed before, and now they're gradually opening. We want them to open faster. That's why Hank Paulson was over there trying to talk some sense into the Chinese. Probably is not going to make very much progress on that anytime soon. China is open for American consumer goods, and since China joined the WTO 10 years ago, the market has opened to Western goods, just not all of them. So some Western companies, American companies, are already doing well. Think of General Motors. Of course, they make more money in China than they do in the United States now.
Well, part of that is because if you want to import a car into China right now, the import tariff is 20.5%, whereas if China wants to import a car into the United States, the import tariff is less than 2%.
Yeah, well, China doesn't make cars that are good enough for the United States right now. They don't meet safety requirements. You know, we don't even trust their seafood. And
no,
their
but my point is they're protecting their domestic economy. Why are you asserting, Robin Meredith, that it's good for us that suddenly American workers are competing with an additional 2 billion people?
I say it's good for the American economy. I say that workers ought to be very, very concerned. 1 billion people have just been added to the global labor pool. We had a free pass from competition with these two giant nations for about the last 50 years because they themselves disconnected from the global economy. Now we're connected with them again, and our workers are competing with Chinese and Indian workers who are paid much less, and I think American workers should be very concerned. American consumers are benefiting. We're seeing lower prices.
But we have lower wages. American consumers are also American workers.
Mm-hmm, absolutely right. There's a complicated interaction. But if you look at the American economy, you'll see that overall it's benefiting. I'll tell you why I think it's so hard to explain.
But wait a minute. If the economy is all the people and all the workers, I mean, if you want to define the economy as investors, the investor class, and you know, CEO salaries and the wealth of corporations, then yeah, they're doing great. But we've seen wages completely flat since Reagan became president, since this frenzy to, quote, open the United States starting in the 80s. We're seeing the destruction, essentially, of the American middle class, certainly of American manufacturing. We've got Border Patrol guys down the southern and the northern borders who are wearing uniforms made in Mexico. We can't manufacture a missile in the United States without parts from China, which has threatened to nuke us if we try to defend Taiwan. This seems to me like it's very, very useful for transnational, multinational corporations, very helpful to people like Tom Friedman, who's worth $3 billion, and screws the rest of America.
Tom, you know, it's hard to summarize a book about all of India and all in China in a few minutes on a radio show. And my book actually makes the point that you made earlier about the erosion of the American middle class. So there's much more in the book than I can possibly convey in 2 minutes' time. But the consumers also benefit in America. It's not just the fat cats. The fat cats benefit, that's clear. Rising income inequality is absolutely alarming. And if we Americans don't pay attention to what's going on and pull our own socks up, we're going to lose more ground. Americans are not as rich as they think they are. The rise in the stock market and the rise in home prices have made us feel richer than we are. And really, if you look at the U.S., we have debt levels and credit card debt levels that show that we are struggling as a nation. The middle classes and lower classes are struggling.
Yeah, and I would submit that much of this is the consequence of the trade agreements that, you know, Ross Perot was warning us about back in the 92 election that you're celebrating in your book.
The data simply don't support what you're saying, Tom. I'm sorry. You know, the economy let me give you an example. Americans who have a mortgage, on average, save $100 a month Their low mortgage costs are $100 a month lower because of China's effect on the global economy. Now, your point is, hey, but if I lose my job, what do I care? I can't pay the mortgage anyway. You're right.
No, that's actually, in that context, my point would be that our mortgage rates are lower because of China's effect, because China has such a massive surplus of dollars that they're reinvesting those dollars by buying American companies. And eventually, as they buy more and more American companies and more American debt, they're going to own our country.
They're buying more American bonds. They're not buying more American companies yet. They could in the future.
They're buying our debt, and they've got a $1.2 trillion sovereign wealth fund.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that is making mortgages cheaper in the United States. Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. But you were asking, is it better or worse for Americans? And my point is, for consumers, it's better. We save $100 a month on our mortgages. We have lower prices at Walmart. And all of us benefit from that. Here's why I think it's so difficult to grasp the overall benefits. If all of us in America save $100 a month on our mortgage, we're happy, but it doesn't change our life. If some of us lose our jobs, we and our families are devastated by the effects. What I try to explain in the book is that the global economy has changed. We can't put that genie back in the bottle even if we want to. We can't stop it.
Why not?
Sorry. How would you do it, Tom?
I would do away with the trade agreements and go back to using tariffs as an instrument of trade policy.
Mm-hmm.
I would go back to Adam Smith 101.
Right. Well, you could do that.
It
but
worked
I
for
think
200 years in this country, and it built the biggest, the strongest industrial power in the world.
Yeah. I don't think it would work for long in this global economy.
It's always been a global economy, Robin. We've always had a global economy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've been trading with the British East India Company no longer exists, but we traded with them for over 100 years. We essentially fought a war against them, and then we continue to trade with them. We've always had a global economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't for the last 50 years because two of the biggest players haven't been participating in it, and now they are. I think the reality has changed. Globalization is here to stay. We can't really stop it. We can delay it, but then you'd lose a lot of the benefits that are coming to the consumers around the world.
Lower mortgage payments and cheaper stuff at Walmart. But if my paycheck is 40% lower and, I talk to average Americans constantly, on the radio here, I mean, all the time. And there's a pervasive sense across this country that the loss of pensions, the loss of health insurance, the lower wages, the loss of unionization in the United States, the hollowing out of our manufacturing sector, all of these things that are the direct consequence of these trade deals that you're celebrating are not worth cheap stuff from Walmart and $100 less a month on our mortgages.
Well, that's a decision we have to make as a nation. You know, Tom, nobody's forcing people to buy at Walmart. We Americans could preserve American jobs if we simply shopped locally, if all of us collectively refused to go to Walmart.
There are many communities, Robin, in the United States where there is nothing but Walmart. You get these large predatory companies. This is why India prevents this from happening. This is why, by law, in India, 97% of the entire retail sector is owned by small local businesses, and they're not opening. They're saying absolutely no, not just to Walmart U.S., but to Walmart India, to indigenous companies. They will not allow it because I used to live in Burlington, Vermont. A Walmart moved into town. Half the locally owned businesses in town closed. The closest place you could buy bedding, I remember this specifically. I wanted to buy a new pillow. The closest place I could buy that was not a Walmart was more than 100 miles away. And so I would say, in fact, people are being forced to buy from Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm surprised that you bring up India as a solution to that. I mean, the average Indian is not happy that their only choice is a mom-and-pop store that charges five times more than they would otherwise have to pay. They're not happy that they don't have as many job opportunities because their economy is so closed that they're not getting investment in new jobs and factories that would provide jobs for Indians. And, of course, Indians earn far, far less than we in the United States. The other big effect of globalization that I think that your argument forgets about is that it has a huge benefit for poor people overseas. 200 million people, Indians and Chinese, have been lifted out of dire poverty, dollar-a-day poverty, in the 1990s alone. And I think that's a massive achievement.
But is that our obligation? Is it the obligation of the United States to impoverish itself to raise India and China?
No, and you know what? The United States doesn't have to impoverish itself. The United States has to pay attention to changes in the global economy. We have to improve our education system. We have to send more of our kids to college. We could improve our infrastructure and create jobs here. We could have local, state, and federal governments focus on creating the environment that creates jobs in the United States. And then we would create a lot of jobs in the United States that can't be taken away by anyone.
For example, I mean, the last time I was in India, I was down in southern India, and Microsoft was running a job fair. They were hiring 10,000 engineers,
mm-hmm.
and they were paying $12,000 an hour for people with a master's degree.
You mean $12 an hour?
$12,000 a year.
A year,
was
yes.
the starting salary for people with a master's degree as engineers.
You're right, and you know what? Like Microsoft,
I was there,
every
I saw it.
Absolutely. I see it all the time in my job as a foreign correspondent. That's why I wrote this book. There are these huge changes going on.
So how can somebody get a master's degree in computer science here in the United States? How can that possibly help them if Microsoft is going to India and hiring people for $12,000 a year?
Because there are jobs being created in the United States that are create demand for different skills,
for example,
at the same time. Well, the best example I know of is the iPod. You know, the chip of the iPod, the brains of the iPod, was created by a company, invented by a company in Hyderabad, India. They sold it to Apple, who designed and marketed this amazing, amazing invention that many of us enjoy. The iPod is made in China, largely by Taiwanese companies, and sold and marketed in the United States. That created a lot of jobs for Apple in the United States in marketing and design and all kinds of high-end white-collar jobs, even though it didn't happen to create jobs in designing computer chips that created the iPod. If we'd thought of it first, then we would have done it first, but we didn't. They thought of it in India. Apple is the one that benefits from it, and consumers, too. And, you know, we're going to see more and more products like that. That's what I see when I'm there. I, too, am alarmed by the number of white-collar jobs moving to India and increasingly China. But I don't think the solution is to put our head in the sands. I think the solution is to say, you know what, we've got to work harder. We've got to compete. We've got to find new jobs to do in the United States.
There's 5 billion people out there. Well, there's 3 billion people out there living on less than $2 a day. We have to compete with all of them.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
We do.
The Brave New World. Robin Meredith, the book, read it and make up your own mind. The Elephant and the Dragon, The Rise of India and China and What It Means for All of Us. Foreign correspondent for Forbes magazine, lives in Hong Kong. Robin Meredith, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Tom.
Good, spirited conversation.
20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America. 866-303-2270, airamerica.com for our blog. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Five minutes past the hour. Stuart in the Bronx, New York. Hey, Stuart, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great to be on again. First of all, I can't believe I'm not going to be in the city tonight because I'm on my way to Ohio, but I would have totally been there tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be a hoot, and it's a great movie. I've seen it, and it's Leo DiCaprio taking Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth to the next level. I mean, you know, it's a movie about the environment, and it's extraordinary. It's a feature-length movie.
I can't wait to see it.
Documentary.
Hey. I'm sure you're going to go with this anyway, but it seemed like she was like this woman was defeating her own arguments. I mean, I don't know where she was coming from at sometimes. And plus, I got to throw a flag about that whole thing about the iPod because, you know, everything that Apple design has been built in Cupertino, California. I can't buy it's basically all the iPod is a hard drive. I don't know which chip she was talking about, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it's like, you know, looking around the world for examples of, gee, isn't this great? Didn't this work out well? And, you know, again, I don't want to trash her. She's not here to defend herself. But Tom Friedman I'll trash enthusiastically because he's the guy who really started this with the olive tree and the Lexus. I mean, you know, convincing Bill Clinton to go down this road and everybody else. And the bottom line is that if we're going to really and truly compete with 5 billion people or 6 billion people on the planet, I mean, we're a country of about 110 million workers, and there are 6 billion humans on the planet, and probably, you know, a billion or 2 billion of them are at least solidly of working age, then we're screwed. I mean, you know, kiss America goodbye. And it's just a tragedy. Stuart, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your kind words. One of these days we'll hook up, or we'll say hi. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
34 minutes past the hour. The consequences of insane economic policies just since George W. Bush became president and took us back to Reaganomics, the golden age of Reaganomics. Yes, let's have more voodoo economics. As Bernie Sanders noted, over just since Bush took the reins of the economy, over 5 million people have slipped into poverty. Nearly 7 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Median household income has gone down by nearly $1,300. 3 million manufacturing jobs have been lost. 3 million American workers have lost their pensions. Home foreclosures are now the highest on record. The personal savings rate is below zero, which hasn't happened since the Great Depression. The real earnings of college graduates have gone down by 5% in the last few years. Entry-level wages for both male and female high school graduates have fallen by over 3%, and wages and salaries are now the lowest share of GDP since 1929. Oh, but the economy is doing just marvelous. It's downright crazy.
Baby, I'm crazy.
And there's a few other crazy things out there. I got to tell you about this one. I remember back when I was living in Montpelier, Vermont, back about 10 years ago, and or however many years ago it was. 5 years ago, something like that. I can't keep track of time. Anyhow, I was living in Montpelier, and Howard Dean was the governor, and they were going to pass the civil unions legislation, and Dean was going to sign it. And these wackos from this church, this Baptist church, Fred Phelps, Westboro Baptist Church, we had to walk by them standing out in front of the Capitol with their big God Hates Fags signs. They took these to the funerals of American soldiers, saying that American soldiers were dying in Iraq because we allow gay, fill in the blank. I mean, we allow gays to survive, I guess, in the United States because apparently they believe that they should be stoned to death, and they don't mean with pot. And now comes this. The Westboro Baptist Church has issued this news release. Thank God, I'm quoting them, thank God for Minneapolis bridge collapse. I can't even do this in my own voice. This is so. WBC, this is the Westboro Baptist Church, to picket the memorial services for the dead in religious protest and warnings. God is not mocked. Galatians 6:7. God hates fags and fag enablers. Ergo, God hates Minneapolis and Minnesota, land of the sodomite damned. WBC will also picket the funerals of those whom a sovereign God abruptly snatched from the bridge in Minneapolis and cast into hell. Yes, they really are going to Minneapolis to celebrate the death of people on those bridges. And I just have to say, you know, I'm sure Reverend Phelps and your merry band, I'm sure you guys think you're doing the right thing. I'm sure you think that you found it in the Bible. But it's a typo. Or maybe you're dyslexic. Nowhere in the Bible does it say God hates fags. Instead, in Matthew, the first book of the New Testament, Matthew 21, chapter 21, verse 18 and 20, 18, 19, and 20, Jesus is walking down a road, and he sees a fig tree by the road. He came to it, found nothing on it, but leaves only, and said to it, "Let no fruit grow henceforth forever," and presently the fruit tree withered away. Or Mark, the second Matthew, Mark, yeah, the second book, Mark 11, 12, 14. Again, he curses a fig tree. Jesus curses a fig tree. The psalmist, David, King David, he destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamore figs with sleet. Eat a fig, go to hell, you see. And Jeremiah, one of the greatest of the fire and brimstone prophets. Jeremiah 20:29-17. "Yes, this is what the Lord God Almighty says. I will send the sword, famine, and plague against them, and I will make them like poor figs that are so bad they cannot be eaten." Do you get it? God doesn't hate fags. He hates figs. Somebody needs to tell Fred Phelps. You can read all about it over at GodHatesFigs.com. It's very well documented. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. No, you had that expert, Robin Meredith. She was talking about globalization.
Yes, she actually is an author. Well, and she's a reporter for Forbes magazine.
Yeah, I'm from India. You know, the problem is globalization is not fair. That is the problem. See, the Microsoft paid $12,000 for a software engineer there. For $12,000, it's like equivalent to paying $200,000 here. You know, you can live like a king there.
Yeah.
So that's why it's a lot of money. But then Microsoft doesn't have to spend that much money. They have to spend at least $60,000 or more here. So they save the money. And this is a problem. And then Tom Friedman, he says, one of the statements he said was that India and China produces 10 times or 5 times more engineers and scientists than here. And that's because the population there is 5 times the population here. The percentage of people going for engineering and science degrees is the same as here.
Yeah.
But the population is 5 times the population here.
Oh, that's a good point. We have 300 million people. They have over a billion. India has over a billion. China has over a billion. And so if you have 4% of your population going to college to become an engineer, it's the same in all three countries.
Right. And nobody questioned Tom on that.
Yeah.
That is another point. Another point about the productivity here, they say, you know, it's increasing. I don't think so. Because, see, China, they pay $1 an hour. And suppose the guy produces one car per hour. Here you pay $20 per hour. You have to put in 20 cars to meet the same productivity.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Dave. And that's why we used to have tariffs where we said if you're going to make a pair of shoes if making a pair of shoes in the United States, for example, just to use shoes as an example, and there's a dollar's worth of labor, you know, in general consensus, there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in the United States, and you want to make those shoes in China, that's fine. We can't stop you from doing that. We're not talking about actual physical barriers to trade. But if there's only 20 cents worth of labor in that pair of shoes in China, when you import them into the United States, you pay an 80-cent tariff, an 80-cent tax, so that no matter where you make them, it costs you a dollar, basically, for your labor. And that's how we protected the American working class in the United States for over 200 years. And China is still doing that. If you want to import a car into China, they charge a 20% import tariff. They're protecting their economy. We're not protecting ours. India is protecting its economy. Walmart desperately wants to go into India. And India is saying, no, no way. We will not allow you in. So, you know, geez, we're not supposed to protect their economy. We're supposed to say, oh, no, free trade is wonderful. It's a wonderful thing, free trade, because after all, the transnational corporations do very well. Dave, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. It's a beautiful day here in Colorado.
Oh, it is here in New York City, too.
Yeah. Gas prices, boy, they're down. And, of course, my electricity cost, you know, that's up through the ceiling. And
the economy's doing wonderful, isn't it, Jeff?
Oh, Lockheed Martin's making a ton of money.
Yeah.
I just talked to my purveyor, who I buy my supplies from, and I said, boy, am I the only one that my business is down? And he said, no.
Yeah.
He said it's straight across the board, all the way across the board.
Except in the defense industries.
Except for the defense industry. And, of course, here we have a big pharmaceutical influx. So, you know, the pharmaceutical industry seems to be doing fairly well, but this Robin that you had on, you're supposed to work harder. There's 54 homes in the neighborhood that I live in that are in foreclosure. You know, in 2000, I was making 70% more than I am right now.
Yeah.
And you can see when the gas prices went up, my revenue just dropped to the floor, absolutely to the floor. And so she's telling me I'm supposed to work harder. There aren't any more hours in the day. I can't work more hours. I can't work any harder. I can't handcuff people and make them buy stuff when they don't have money to buy things with. It's absolutely ridiculous.
It's the triumph of trickle-down economics, or the mindset of trickle-down economics versus classic demand-side economics. You know, if everybody makes more money, everybody buys more stuff, and that stimulates the economy. And instead, what we have is a very small number of people getting mind-bogglingly wealthy, and a little bit trickles down, and so the rest of us become peons.
Yeah, here they put in a new Walmart, and they had such a protest against the Walmart that the city council actually put the vote on the ballot. They wanted people to vote on it. And so if you were voting no for Walmart, that meant that you were voting yes for Walmart, because they had it all twisted around.
So they used a double negative in the you know, it's funny. I have a funny story similar to that. Selwood is a region in Portland where I live. And I was walking down the street in the Selwood area, and Walmart wants to build a Walmart in there. And there's a local group that is like no to Walmart. I mean, they're really aggressive. And there was this guy standing out on the street on Tacoma, on the main street there that comes off the Selwood Bridge, holding up this sign saying something like, you know, Walmart means good jobs, or yes to Walmart, or whatever. And I walked up to him and I said, how much are they paying you to carry that sign? And he says, $15 an hour. And it was like, you know, that's the only reason he was doing it. He was making more than a Walmart greeter or somebody at the, you know, I thought it was so weird. Jeff, thanks for the call. I gotta move along here, but I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Stacy in Indiana. Hey, Stacy, you disagree with me.
Well, I don't disagree with you. I agree with all of your points, but I think that she did make some valid points, is that, you know, I agree with everything the guy just said before. I'm working 100 hours a week, and we own our own business, and we watch people drive in SUVs over to Walmart 10 miles away, and they have nice homes, and, I mean, they're exploiting people, and, you know, people have to take some responsibility for their actions. I mean, you know.
But see, it's the rules of the game that have changed, Stacey.
Well, I understand that, but they really do. I mean, I live in an area where, you know, it's like go Colts, you know. I mean, these people just, I went to Mike Pence town hall meeting 2 weeks ago and wanted to say something, but listened to everybody talk, and I left crying. I mean, where's the common sense with these people? My dad, you know, talked about standing and not having a job and striking when I was a kid, and I remember those days, and now he's working at Walmart.
Yep. Stacey, I'm out of town, but great point. Thank you for making it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Are we a nation of barn builders? Are we a nation of community? Or are we a nation of selfish, rugged individualists? I really think that we have always been a nation that was collectively in this together. You read the Constitution. Just read the preamble to the Constitution. They lay it out so clearly. So clearly. And our trade policies and our economic policies, frankly, have historically reflected that and should again. We really need to be repudiating the Reagan Revolution. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Hey. Well, quite a bit actually not going on at the same time things are going on. I guess I want to start with the FISA issue, which I know you've been talking about on the air today, and the fact that even if this all goes through, which it is, et cetera, there is absolutely nothing in place in the legislation to figure out how they're going to deal with these reports, who's going to deal with them, how they're going to deal with the readouts of them. None of that is being done.
Really?
So here you have legislation, and then we don't know who's supervising it, and there's no mechanism in the bill, as I understand it, to really figure out who's going to supervise this, how they're going
to
release
the data. Well, it's up to Gonzo, isn't it?
Et cetera. Well, enforcement would be up to him, but not necessarily. Usually, you know, that is done actually by the various committees and by the House administration or Senate administration, that kind of thing.
Right.
But, no, Gonzo would be, and the Justice Department would be up to it if there's a referral. But then, is there any mechanism in the legislation for a referral?
Well, that's interesting.
So,
because it used to be that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court would do that, right?
No, that's right. That's right. But where,
so if the court saw something wrong, they would say, "Hey, wait a minute."
Keep track of all this is a real question. There was just a letter sent just literally a few minutes ago. Well, it wasn't sent a few minutes ago. It was released by the Republicans a few minutes ago, saying essentially that there is a problem because of all of this. I mean, they didn't put it as a problem. They put it as a very positive thing that this FISA thing had passed, et cetera. But there's a problem as to the amount of staff time it would take on some of this. So there's already some real questions about this.
Yeah. Now, with USA Today, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all strongly editorializing today that, in the opinion of these three publications, you know, arguably the three major publications of the United States, I guess the LA Times has weighed in on this as well, that this small number of Democrats and the vast majority of the Republicans, virtually all of the Republicans, 16 Democrats in the Senate, 41 Democrats in the House, have been cowed. They've been frightened by Bush. Bush is terrorizing people.
Well, he's trying to embarrass them politically as they're home for vacation.
I would take it a step beyond that. I would say that he's using the threat of terror to achieve his political goals. And I'm not sure what beyond that would be the definition of a terrorist. Well, actually, he's not killing people. Terrorists tend to kill people, but
political terror.
Yeah, I'm walking right up to the edge of calling George Bush a terrorist. I'm not going to step over that edge, but I'm damn close to it. I'm just horrified by this, frankly.
Well, and it's very clear the Republicans, by putting out this letter today, are really trying to. It's the Director of National Intelligence letter to the Senate, and essentially the Senate Republicans Communication Center put out the letter that he wrote to Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell on this.
Yeah.
That's interesting, but I think there's a lot of gray area in this legislation. Now, speaking of not so gray areas, the Taliban launched a frontal attack on a coalition, which is, of course, U.S. coalition based in southern Afghanistan. They were able to fight it back. 20 of the Taliban are dead. But what's interesting is they used gunfire, grenades, and 107-millimeter rockets. And the army captain, who is the coalition spokesperson, said that the inability of the insurgent forces to inflict any severe damage on this fire base while being decimated in the process should be clear indication of the ineffectiveness of their fighters. Well, yes. But the fact that they had 20, you know, that they had, well, more than 20 people, 75 people challenging directly an American coalition based
This PR that we're putting out reminds me of the way the Russians were talking 25 years ago, 35 years ago.
Right. Well, Afghanistan's a not dissimilar situation.
Well, that's what I mean. That's the way that the Russians were talking about their experience in Afghanistan. We're going to win just another year, you know, or the British in Afghanistan in the 1920s.
What can I say? I completely agree with you on that one. The Plain Dealer in Cleveland, Ohio, put out a very interesting thing in a letter saying that John Boehner of Ohio meets weekly with President Bush to plot strategy on how to win back the House, et cetera. Well, now, this is in itself is not staggering news, except for the fact when you put it together with Nancy Pelosi saying last week that she had to, it took her, you know, a long time to get a face-to-face meeting with the president. Where are the priorities here?
Right. It's not about legislation. It's not about what's best for America. It's not about doing the people's business. It's about having what Karl Rove called the permanent Republican majority, 100 years of Republican rule, which in other countries has been referred to as a single-party state.
Yes. And one thing you may have missed, because in the August recess people miss a lot of things, Hill News today put out a very interesting piece on Ron Paul and said that he is getting a number of contributions from military. And although it's not an enormous amount of money, he's got his second quarter got $2.4 million. He's waiting, obviously, for the Iowa straw poll to take place next, I think it's Saturday. But here you have a guy who is the only Republican that has come out against the war, and he's beginning to get those kind of contributions.
That's very interesting. And he's a guy who is a principled libertarian. I mean, you know, I disagree with him on a lot of things, but I respect the fact that he speaks his truth consistently.
He certainly does.
Yeah. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Bruce Barry coming up next. Speechless, the book.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Are we losing our ability to speak? I remember right after 9/11, Louise and I drove out to Michigan. It must have been January, February, something like that. It's right after Bill Maher got thrown off the air for saying that he felt that the hijackers, although they were totally wrong and what they did was totally evil, demonstrated some level of personal courage in that they were willing to die for their beliefs, which I think is an honest statement. But he got canned, and we were in Michigan and we were at this restaurant with my parents and with some friends with some family, and We genuinely felt like if there were some things that had we said them, even in the course of conversation, it would put us at risk. I mean, that's how bizarre it was right after 9/11. And Bush is trying to keep that going and keep us terrified. And increasingly, Americans are giving up their basic freedoms for, you know, like Ben Franklin pointed out, for a little security. Bruce Barry is with us. Speechless. The book is his website. He's a professor of management and sociology at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, president of the American Civil Liberties Union of Tennessee, and author of a new book, Speechless, The Erosion of Free Speech in the American Workplace. Bruce Barry, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
I started out with a more general example. Your book is looking at the American workplace. What's the nature of the loss of speech in the workplace?
Well, people have very few free speech rights when they go to work, and they don't realize it, although they're starting to, because we hear about stories of people getting in trouble. I'm interested in any situation where somebody's speech, whether it's at work or after work, whether it has to do with the job, the workplace, the employer, or not, attracts the attention, disapproval, and ultimately sanction from the employer. And what I argue in the book is that this is a widespread problem, not just making workplaces maybe a little more unpleasant, a little more tyrannical, but it's a problem for society. It's a problem for the kind of free speech enterprise we want to define our kind of collective community experience. And so I think that's why it's important. The example you gave, Bill Maher, you know, a celebrity, a broadcaster, that's an extreme example because he is paid to speak, but his employer, I suppose, could choose to not pay him to not speak if they don't like what he's saying.
Which is true of all of us in the media.
Yeah, same for you as well.
Yeah. But the point is, or I guess my question is, we have in the United States, I think probably for most of the history of this country, viewed the workplace as something that is not a democratic institution. I mean, it's not. The workplace is basically a kingdom. It's a recreation of the old European feudal system. And the attempt to bring some small measure of democracy and pushback into that is called the union movement. And, you know, Abe Lincoln, our first president to actually prevent strike breaking
and used, and back in the 1860s, the word strike, when it was in newspaper headlines, was always in quotes. It was so new. And that's about it. I mean, and unionization now in the United States, we're down to what, 7 to 9% of the private workforce.
Private sector, that's right.
Yeah, is unionized. So if we accept the notion, and I think a lot of Americans do, frankly, unfortunately, that the workplace is a kingdom and that they have to bow to the will of the king. What, first of all, what does that mean for how we perceive democracy and government and society at large? Because it seems to me like there's a huge bleed over here. And secondly, how do we make the workplace more democratic?
Well, a lot of people would say, well, heck, work is for work, and you do your speech and you do your democracy after work, nights and weekends on your own time. And the problem I have with that, even though there's some validity to it, but the problem I have with it is that, first of all, it's not always so easy to know what's on work and off work. For an increasing number of people, the boundary between work and life is blurred. That has to do with the changing nature of jobs and of employers and of careers, and technology's effect on all of it as well. But the other problem I have with that is it ignores the fact that work is a place where people live out their lives. You know, work is where a lot of adults, it's where they have the most important, maybe even the only real contact with other adults. It's where people form the kind of ties with other humans in their communities that may lead to civic engagement, build what sociologists call social capital. And so work is where life happens. When employers say, you may not speak on the job, you may not speak after work on about anything I disapprove of. I mean, I talk in the book about a woman fired because she had a political bumper sticker on her car in the parking lot that the employer disapproved of. You know, when employers come down that hard, they're basically saying you trade your rights as a citizen, even your off-work rights as a citizen, for job security. Your employer is maybe watching, maybe listening. I'm not going to charge that all employers are. But when somebody loses their job because of what they write on their blog, or because of their bumper sticker, or because of their participation in some community activism or community enterprise, it sends a chilling message to everyone else. And this matters because, we bemoan all the time the decline of civic engagement in this country. And if workplaces are forcing people to choose between citizenship and job security, it's no wonder that that's happening.
Yeah, so what do we do about this, Bruce Perry?
Well, the problem is partially the law, constitutional law, which says that private parties, like private employers, don't have to grant any sort of
the right to contract, right. Basically. The terms of employment are a private contract, and the government can't butt into that. Is that what you're
saying? The Constitution and the Bill of Rights do not extend to private property. So if you work for a private employer, you pretty much have no rights at all. Employment law, which in the United States, the employment at will system, if you're not unionized or have some other form of exception, you can be fired for any reason. So the law conspires, if you will, to give employers a whole lot of power here. And so one of the remedies is to change the law. I might like to see some wholesale changes to fundamental underpinnings of constitutional law or employment law. Not going to happen anytime soon. But there are smaller bore changes to the law that could happen. There are some states, for example, that have better protections than other states for off-work activity against employer sanction. There are some states that have protections for political activity. We could see a spread of those laws through the states. That would help. But I think the bigger change that's needed is a change in the mindset of employers in this country who see their relationship with their employees purely as a labor market transaction, don't understand the importance of how that labor market transaction is actually embedded in a democratic society and a democratic system, and how it really matters that employees, that workers in this country, and I'm not just talking about, you know, low-level workers. I'm talking about everything all the way up to executive suites. I mean, top-level managers have the same problem that lower-level workers do here, that their speech rights are pretty much non-existent or clearly at risk. Right. And I'd like to see employers understand that those speech rights matter. They matter for society, the health of a deliberative democracy, and that they don't necessarily threaten the business. You know, mine is not a manifesto for anything goes.
I find
of course
it,
employers don't have to tolerate abusive, harassing, hateful speech.
Yeah. Well, there are limits, and there are limits at law, for that matter, in that regard. But I find it particularly ironic that Nike, for example, took all the way to the Supreme Court in the Caskey versus Nike case.
That's right.
The argument that they had the First Amendment as a person, a corporation as a person, had the legal right, the First Amendment right, to say anything they wanted, even if it was not true in their public relations efforts, because I can tell my wife that I like the dress she's wearing, even if it's not true. I mean, we have the right to lie in this country. You can't, I mean, there are certain circumstances where you can't lie before a grand jury or to police officers, things like that. But basically we have the right to lie. And so here you have Nike taking this all the way to the Supreme Court, claiming the right to lie, the First Amendment free speech. And yet, and not to specifically talk about Nike, which is actually, you know, broadly a fairly well-run corporation, but by and large, in the workplace in the United States, as employers are asserting First Amendment rights in society at large, you're documenting that people, that those same employers in many cases are saying to their employees, sorry, you don't have First Amendment rights when you walk on the premises of our property.
Right, and what they're often saying is, hey, when, on your own time, feel free to participate in community and politics and speech, but make sure it's not connected with us, and if we don't like it, we reserve the right to do something about it. And you're right, Tom, there is this perverse imbalance where corporations at the same time assert their own corporate free speech rights, which, of course, the Supreme Court has bought into over the last 30 years, and it does create that bizarre imbalance where corporate speech is protected and employee speech is not.
Yeah. So, you know, Pennsylvania, you've got over 100 communities now who have passed laws, you know, with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF.org, laws saying that corporations don't have the rights of persons in their town. Is there a legislative remedy like this that like is being done in Pennsylvania that could be done nationwide to say, hey, wait a minute, a corporation is not a person. They are subject to the will of the people.
I'm not aware that that kind of legislative remedy has legs because, let's face it, we don't have to go as far as total personhood. But the idea that corporations have these person-like free speech rights is grounded in Supreme Court rulings.
Yeah, it goes back to Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not going to change with Judge Roberts as the Chief Justice. I mean, he's one of the biggest champions of corporate personhood out there.
The better route is states changing employment laws,
yeah,
granting employees individual rights.
Okay, you can read all about it in the book Speechless, The Erosion of Free Speech, Free Expression in the American Workplace. Speechlessthebook.com. Bruce Berry. Thanks, Bruce, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Tell me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back just 'cause you're half insane. Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
And we all hope it comes to a reasonably soon end via the process of impeachment. Just a couple of things flying under the radar. Did you notice, it has been reported in the news, in my opinion it should be screaming headline at the top of the page, but it's not, that there are now no Sunnis in the Iraqi government, in the Iraqi administration. The executive branch of the Iraqi administration. They have all left. Iraq's political crisis worsened Monday as five more ministers announced a boycott of cabinet meetings, leaving the embattled prime minister's unity government with no members affiliated with Sunni political factions. Now, there are still Sunnis in the parliament, but in the executive branch, none. That's going to give them a lot of credibility in a country that's majority, or that is majority Shiite and has a but has a sizable Sunni majority or minority. And it's really going to, you know, cause the Sunni countries around them, Saudi Arabia and Jordan and whatnot, you know, the countries to their south and to their west that share borders with them, to look at them and go, let's see, all Shiites in the government and the Shiites run Iran and, I mean, the thing is coming unraveled. It's absolutely coming unraveled. Lila Connors-Peterson and Nadia Connors were on Hannity's show over the weekend talking about Leo DiCaprio's new movie, and which, as I mentioned, if you go to airamerica.com and click on Tom Hartman page, you can get some information. If you live in New York City, about a special advance view that we're going to have tonight. Here's just a little bit of that interaction. This was truly strange.
You're recommending to people to drive less, walk more, eat organic, use less, buy smart. All of these, right? Bring your bags to the grocery store.
We suggest more than that.
So Leonardo, the Learjet limousine liberal, produces this film telling us out here that we've got to walk to work. Why won't he take a pledge and promise never to get in a private jet again? And why should anybody take anything you guys are saying in this film as credible?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is called killing the messenger. This is from Sean Hannity, the guy who will only take private jets wherever he travels, as far as I know, from what I've read in press reports. This is absolutely obscene to say, well, you know, somebody who travels doesn't have the right to discuss traveling. Well, first of all, Leonardo DiCaprio does fly commercial. In fact, when he went to the Cannes Film Festival where they premiered this movie, they lost his luggage. I mean, they lost his luggage. So, you know, come on, Sean. But beyond that, Hannity going off in this interview, and this is just a tragic, it was a brilliant interview. Lila and Nadia absolutely comported themselves so well. And this is an absolutely brilliant movie, The 11th Hour, Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie. 11th Hour, 11thhourfilm.com is the website for the movie. You can see the trailer up at the top of tomhartman.com. And as I mentioned, for the New York sneak peek tonight, there's some information over at airamerica.com. But when you know that the Reich is collapsing, you know that Hannity has lost it. When their arguments are so intellectually and morally bankrupt that the only thing that they can say is, we don't like the guy who's delivering the message. And that's the essence of this. Oh, we don't like the guy who's delivering the message. And yet, frankly, I got to tell you, the guy who's delivering the message is doing damn good. Leo DiCaprio's out there doing an awful lot in his own life. He's making a lot of these changes himself. I mean, the guy's driving around in a Prius. He's flying commercial. He is buying carbon offsets. And yet, frankly, it doesn't matter in my mind. What matters is the message. And he's put together this brilliant message. These guys on the Reich, they go after Al Gore and they go after Leo DiCaprio for pointing out that we have a problem, rather than discussing the problem, because there's so much money to be made with this problem continuing. So you get these guys on the Reich who are funded with, well, as Al Gore pointed out in Singapore yesterday, at least a $10 million campaign to deny global warming, coming from companies that, guess what, are producing carbon. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Well, there's people and more people. What do they know? No. Go to work in the summer, high rise, and vacation down at Gulf of Mexico. Oh yeah. And there's winners and there's losers, but that ain't no big deal, 'cause the simple man, baby, pays the thrills, the bills, the pills that care.
Well, I'll tell you, it's definitely not Canada. On January 30th, a year ago, January 30th, what was that, like 16 months, 18 months ago, whatever it was, there was a mine explosion in Canada. 72 miners trapped for a couple of days. They all walked out alive. Why? Because 100% of the mines in Canada are unionized. And the unions in Canada have required the mine owners to build airtight chambers with stored food and oxygen so that if there's a disaster that lasts more than an hour or so, they can survive. Now, in the United States, interestingly enough, you go check out for example, the SEC filings and some of the press releases from some of the coal mine companies in the United States. They actually brag about the fact that they have busted their unions, thus increasing the value of their stock. They brag about it. This story from CNN. During a press conference Tuesday on the status of six men trapped in a Utah coal mine, Robert E. Murray, chairman of Murray Energy Company and owner of the Crandall Canyon Mine, yelled at circling news helicopters and insisted, "There's no emergency here!" He ordered the sheriff to get rid of the helicopters, screaming on camera to the sheriff, "Get her done!" Murray spent the majority of the conference asserting an earthquake was to blame for the cave-in and repeatedly denied that any mine practices might have played a role. And his extraordinarily generous company had equipped the miners with one-hour respirators. Ain't that nice? The info, by the way, on that for New York City on the movie is over at the AirAmerica.com on the Tom Harbin page. Click the Tom Harbin page. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, AirAmerica.com. If you want to participate in our blog, you can also. There's also a link there to our live chat room. Drop in and say hi. Dave in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. First-time caller, long-time listener. Thank you for what you do.
You're welcome.
Hey,
thank you for listening.
I'm gathering resources to be in D.C. on the 15th of September for what we hope to be a million march. And I am personally taking a page from the Ukraine uprising and going orange.
You know, unfortunately, I think most Americans are going to think it's simply a fashion statement.
Well, maybe if we can get a million of us in orange there, it would be nice.
Yeah.
You're right. But people are reluctant to really show their colors and, I personally am going to, and I'm encouraging others to do the same.
Yeah. I wonder if maybe, I'm trying to, you know, those little plastic wrist things are very popular now. The problem is that there's, you know, so many different groups have claimed them, and they have so many different meanings, it's almost impossible to know. And the same thing, you know, for a while it was with the little lapel pins of the ribbon, you know, and then there was different colors for different things, and those have been diluted. It's pretty much anything that we do becomes a consumer product.
Yeah.
And what's particularly ironic about the Ukraine situation is that we help fund that. There were these seven guys, maybe it was five of them, five or seven guys over in Serbia who had figured out how to do this thing. And the Democratic Party and the Republican Party both have international arms, and then the U.S. government as well, the State Department. And we helped fund moving these guys to the Ukraine, where they came up with this logo of the, you know, I believe it was a ticking clock, and the slogan, "His time is up," and the orange, the whole orange revolution, and you know, we helped put that thing together, and you know, much to the disgust of Vladimir Putin, frankly. But I agree with you, Dave. We need to have something in the United States. But frankly, I don't think that it's going to be in the streets mass movements, because the difference between us and Ukraine is that that happened in the Ukraine in the urban areas. We and really there's only a couple major urban areas in the Ukraine. We my daughter spent almost a year studying Russian and Ukrainian in Ukraine, and I haven't traveled through the Ukraine, but I've been, you know, near there throughout Russia, and it's kind of like it still works there. But here, my sense is that
that it's going to have to be in the blogosphere. It's going to have to be on the telephone. It's going to have to be people contacting their members of Congress. It's going to have to be in the voting booth. It's going to have to be on talk radio. And we want to get people. I'm not saying I don't want people out on the streets. Absolutely. You know, if a million people can get together in Washington, D.C., unfortunately, I'm going to be in Germany that week. But if a million people can come to, you know, be in Washington, D.C. on September 15th and show up and it causes some change, I think it'd be wonderful. I mean, let's not forget, Richard Nixon was intending to use nukes in Vietnam. We now know from the White House tapes. Nixon was intending to use nukes, and all those people, and I think it was close to a million people, came and had this huge protest in Washington, D.C., and it caused him to reconsider and back down from that. So, Dave, I salute you for going, and I wish you well, but we need to do everything else as well. You know, we can't, but you know, good on you. Good on you. Terry in Oregon, in Portland, listening to KPOJ. Hey, Terry, what's up? Terry? No, Terry. Okay, Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Your guest from Forbes today, I think, was one of the more intellectually dishonest people you've had on, especially bad because she sounded so pleasant. But three quick points on that.
Mm-hmm.
One is, hey, if we can't book a great idea here, it's going to be manufactured someplace else.
Secondly, I'm sorry, say that again?
If we did come up with a great idea here, it's just going to be manufactured someplace else.
Oh, it is all the time. I mean, look at all the toys that are, for example, being manufactured in China. I'm guessing the majority of those are probably still designed in the United States. And it's not as if toys are a new invention. And now we're discovering that, you know, hundreds of thousands of them, millions of them are covered with lead paint. And we've been poisoning our kids for a couple of years in the name of profits. I mean, it's absurd. It's obscene.
And point two is, how many times can people be re-educated? I've got friends that are very, very well educated that keep on having to search for high-tech jobs.
Yeah.
The thing about, like, creating a job, say, Apple iPod, hey, how many salespeople did it take for the iPod? It sells itself. Come on. You didn't create jobs there.
Yeah, well, it created jobs of, would you like a carrying case with that?
Yes. And then the third point is, there's a company like, say, Osprey. Backpacking, great, great, great backpacking manufacturer. They really tried hard to employ Native Americans down in Dolores, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very tough for them to keep up because of the wages in China and so forth. So those jobs for manufacturing backpacks are now going overseas.
Yeah.
Or are these Native American people who live hundreds of miles from the university going to go back to university, go into debt, or they don't have a job at all? Because look at students. If you get reeducated each time, students come out of school with enormous debts. Most people are not going to be able to afford to go back and get reeducated, especially when they're in their mid-50s or so.
Yeah. No, you have so eloquently stated the argument against the so-called free trade. It's only free for multinational corporations. It's not free for you and me.
And one other quick point.
Yeah.
All this stuff of manufacturing overseas and so forth, mm-hmm. It's horrible for energy. It takes so much more energy to do these things this
right.
way.
To move things from one end of the world to the other. And excellent points all, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling and making them. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
How you doing, man?
Good.
Hey, I got the guy you had on earlier today about the, you shouldn't be able to vote if you're not paying income tax.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
He's off his rock. 2 points. Say, for example, the dollar crashes and there's 33% unemployment. I mean, it would be like over 50% of the U.S. population wouldn't be able to vote.
Right.
That means that, you know, not only would I have to show up with an ID, I would have to show up with a bank, a check stub. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Now, if he wants to do that, then why not? Companies, corporations that don't pay taxes, shouldn't be allowed to lobby Congress.
Well, I'll go along with that.
You know what I'm saying?
I say corporations shouldn't be allowed to lobby Congress, period.
Exactly, to sway public.
Congress is supposed to represent us.
Exactly.
We the people. Let employees of corporations lobby Congress if they want. If a company, if General Motors can get enough of their employees to go to Washington, D.C. to camp out in the office of John Dingell or Sander Levin or whatever and say, hey, you know, this is what I really want. I think that's a marvelous thing, and corporations should encourage their employees to be politically active. And then you'd have a large semblance of democracy, not just nationally, but in the workplace as well. If you said to corporations, sorry, as a corporation, you can't lobby Congress, you're welcome to encourage your employees to do so. And
exactly.
and the employees will say, I'm going to do this or I'm not going to do this.
Now, your last guest, the most previous.
Yeah.
Why not have that guy talk to the guy about the taxes? You know, I mean, it would make for a great argument. I could see.
Oh, the free speech, Bruce Barry
exactly.
on free speech. Yeah. Yeah.
The first guy wouldn't even come on.
Yeah, it may well be. Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot, Rick. Good to hear from you. Brian in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Brian, just a half a minute before we got to take a break. A quick one?
Maybe you can hold me over.
Your point.
Okay, the point is that the road to Hades is paved with good intentions, and that applies to many of us. I wondered on that very first call, the taxes thing, there are people who, and there's been a lot of things today. We work too much, like the Sunday New York Times, August 5th, their front page article is Millionaires Who Don't Feel Rich. The lead guy has $2 million in the bank. His house is paid off. He works 70-hour weeks.
Right.
That's not
he
a
thinks
lie.
He's the middle class. Yeah.
I mean, I'd wish you'd hold me over, Tom.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry I can't, Brian. I got a whole board here full of folks who want to get in, but you had your say, and a good say it was. Thank you very much for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. The United Kingdom has now come to the United States and said, release the people, these five British residents, not even citizens, just residents. They're starting to push back, a fine thing in America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6:06 before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. Just to wrap up that point about the UK, apparently the Gordon Brown administration has completely broken from the policy of the Blair administration saying, yep, George, anything you want, that's what we'll do. Yep, just your poodle here. Gordon Brown saying, no. His Foreign Secretary David Miliband has sent a formal request to Condi Rice, the U.S. Secretary of State, for the release of the five men who were legally resident in Britain before their detention but are not British nationals. This is a major change in policy coming out of the U.K. And, in my opinion, a fine thing. 1-866-303-2270. Rob in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing out there? It's one of those things trying to get through to you. I got a psychological theory about the conservative mind. A leading talk show host out there has, he does his program with half his brain tied behind his back just to make it fair, okay? Now, his listeners can only use half their brain to understand and agree with him. Wouldn't you agree?
If that.
I would say ditto conservatives, maybe.
If that. Yeah, good.
You know? Okay.
Good
now, the next thing is, if they used all of their brain, wouldn't they be liberal?
Well, that tends to be what happens, and that's why you've got David Horowitz running around hysterical, because, oh, my God, there's liberals on college campuses. Well, yes, when you get educated, when you figure out how the world works, you tend to have a worldview similar to that of Jefferson and Washington and the guys who started this country, the liberal enlightenment, as George Washington said, I hope I shall ever see America at the forefront of liberality. Yeah, good point, Rob. Good point. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Ken in Oregon. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, Tom, your conversation earlier about Sean Hannity criticizing DiCaprio reminded me of all these crazy news stories I keep hearing, like this study out of Britain about how driving is somehow costing less energy than walking. And I think I heard that on KPOJ. And then another story about how cigarettes are better for you than marijuana, that study came out of New Zealand.
Yeah.
But these are just absolutely crazy, these stories.
They're counterintuitive on their face.
My body tells me that walking is better than driving, And my body also tells me that cigarettes are really bad for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well said, Ken. Thank you very much. Albert in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Albert.
Hey, Tom. I was wondering if you could do me a quick favor. You had a show on yesterday that you talked about the catastrophe of how the House and the Senate decided to give Mr. Bush more ability to spy on us. I'm doing a public access show live at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I need to know what the House bill HR was and when did the president sign this terrible surveillance bill.
Mm. Albert, I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me, but it should be A, easy to Google, or B, just, you know, look at any news archive, go to the New York Times, go to thinkprogress.org. I mean, it's all over the place. I just don't have it right on the screen in front of me at the moment, so I'm sorry, but it's out there and it's easy. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, listening on KKZN. Hey, Ralph.
Hi, Tom. You ever see what happens when a Lexus tries to run over an olive tree?
The olive tree wins?
Well, the olive tree loses a little bit of bark. The Lexus is totaled.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of my feeling about Tom Friedman's concepts. He is as right on, how shall I say, globalization as he has been on Iraq.
Well, his position on Iraq has been just give us another, was it three more months or six more months? He's one or the other.
I think that was 48 months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom, yeah. It's, you know.
I mean, if we don't take care of ourselves and try to grow the way the olive tree does, if we just keep consuming the Lexuses, I think it is the same thing as what's going to happen when the car hits the tree.
Yeah. This is what I refer to, Ralph, as the cancer stage of capitalism, of laissez-faire capitalism, when it reaches the point where it starts to destroy its host. It starts to destroy the society that it's operating within. Ralph, thank you for the call. Well said. Artie's in Berkeley, California. Hey, Artie's.
Yeah. But you were talking about globalization, and I go to a good supermarket where they actually say where things are, and there was where produce comes from, and there was a lot of garlic, none of which was from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of us started complaining, and I started talking to people, and I pointed out the local farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, although the store was telling me they didn't grow garlic in California anymore, which I didn't believe. And I recommend people who have a hard time with buying all sorts of produce from other countries to go to their farmers markets. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you said it very well, Artie's, and it's something that Louise and I do, and I recommend as well. Dan in Michigan, just a couple seconds left, Dan.
Hi, Tom. Hey, you know, I'm wondering if, you know, these Democrats aren't cowards. They're more complicit than they are cowardly.
Well, I think some of them are. I mean, you had Joe Lieberman out there being a cheerleader for Bush.
Yeah. I just wonder about that, Tom. They cop to the cowardice to cover their complicity.
But let's keep in mind, it's only 16 Democrats in the Senate, only 41 in the House. The vast majority of Democrats voted against this legislation. The vast majority of Republicans voted for it. We really need to lay the responsibility at the feet of the Republicans, because that's where it belongs. Coming up tomorrow, debating conservative Keith Lockich on environmentalism. Moira Gunn here about biotech. Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org, plus the best of the rest of the news. And remember, my friends, never forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow. Have a great evening.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.